Say something.
Hello, Mike Gibbons.
All right. Now, we are here with John
Jankishe,
the head coach at UMBC. And this guy, we're doing an interview for the Baltimore Baseball Minutes. And John has been the head coach at the UMBC baseball program for 16 years.
16.
And started at the ripe old age of 23 years old. Maybe it would be fun to go back and just briefly talk about how you got to that spot. How did you get started in baseball as a kid? Your dad getting into it, or what happened?
Well, I just grew up in outside of Philadelphia and neighborhood kids, and you lived, slept, and sports. If it was football season, you're playing football and baseball, and whatever season was, you're going to be a pro in that season. So constantly playing all the time. Started to develop some talent in that area, and as went on to high school, started having some success. And I think, as in any field, wherever someone has some success, they're kind of start moving towards that area. So that became, very important to me in terms of baseball, an opportunity to, play at the University of Delaware. And
how hard was it? You're a high school player,
right?
When you started thinking about college, What turned Delaware on to you, or did you just go to find them and knock on the door and say, here I am, and
well,
give me a shot?
In those days, that was back in the early 70s, and college baseball, except I guess in the Sun Belt, really wasn't anything but college sport. It wasn't really promoted. There wasn't a lot of college athletic scholarships for baseball. So really what happened was, wherever you were, I was a resident of Delaware, so that was the place to go. And, I was encouraged to come out for the baseball team. I wasn't highly recruited. I was a good high school player. So it was the state school. We went there, you tried out for the team, and I made it.
What were you?
I started off as a shortstop pitcher, and as happened so many cases, what you star at in high school is not quite, because all the kids were outstanding players coming out of high school and they go to college. So I was quickly shifted to the outfield. Didn't have that, wasn't as good as some of the other kids.
So you stayed for 4 years at Delaware?
Yeah.
And then what happened to you?
Well, at Delaware, I started off as a business administration major, and that was one semester. And my love was in sports, and I wanted to enjoy my life, and I saw what I thought was decent lifestyle of my coaches, and so I said physical education and would be the route to go in order to be a college coach. And so after my 4 years there, I had an opportunity to get a graduate assistantship at Indiana University in the Big Ten, and they set it up. I had some connections where I could coach the JV team out there, so I added to my resume to a certain extent in terms of qualifications. And But my heart was set on coaching college baseball, and just started beating down the doors and writing every college that there was where there was specific opening, and things just weren't happening. I didn't realize the job market for college baseball coaches wasn't as great. It wasn't a great turnover every year. So I just kept on looking and looking and knocking on doors.
What year was this?
That was graduated in 1970, summer of 1976. And came back and to Delaware and worked as a my former head coach, University of Delaware, got me a position at Cecil Community College, which is up there in Maryland, and coached on a part-time basis there for that year and continued to look for it. Yeah, so I kept on looking for I wanted to coach on the college level, 4-year level, and had an opportunity to, through that job search, meet some people down in Baltimore, actually over at Dundalk Community College. The athletic director was impressed with me, with my credentials, but the job I was interviewing for, it really wasn't, it was more of a facilities coordinator. And just didn't work out, but he kept in touch. He said, I'll keep my eyes out for you, and because his contacts, that type of thing. And evidently he received a job notice from UMBC, which they probably sent out to all the local colleges saying they're looking for a baseball coach. So interviewed for the job, and I guess that was sometime in August. And
Same year.
August of 77.
Right.
And just got married in July, and Didn't have a job, came back, went for a second interview, and was offered the position, and moved to Baltimore end of August.
And how old were you?
23.
So, you started in September?
September, right.
When you first dealt with your first class of kids coming in, your first team, how did they accept you?
Well, I was so, I guess you could consider it cocky. I was so well trained by the coaches at the University of Delaware and then the coaches at Indiana University in the Big Ten. I believed that I knew it all. And I had so much confidence in teaching the game. Because I wasn't a great player, but I was taught how to be an excellent college player. And so I knew that if a young man had talent in terms of physical talent and he had a heart for the game and really wanted to learn, I felt I could teach him. And I came from programs where there was discipline and organization, that type of thing. So I let those guys know right then that I was coach. I wasn't John, even though some of them were a year or two younger than I am. And took them probably, they tested me for a little while, maybe a week or two during our fall practices. But then they realized I believed in myself and I believed in what I could do for them, and they caught on. And those first 2 years, we went to the NCAA tournament in Division II. So you know, I gained their respect pretty quick.
You have a good reputation as a baseball coach in Baltimore. Tell me about your 16-year tenure, some of the high points,
well, some of the low points. Yeah, well, for I guess the last 7 years, we've been NCAA Division I. So before that, we were at Division II, and we had no scholarships, no athletic grant money. But there is so much talent in the Baltimore metropolitan area. I mean, I'd like to take some of the credit for our success in terms of I can offer the kids a opportunity to learn how to play the game, and I teach them. I know what it takes to win, you know, from a skill standpoint, and then we try to put it together even further in terms of creating a team concept and do it in a first-class manner in terms of our attitude and our hustle, that type of thing. But I've been blessed with kids walking on who are talented ball players. I've had kids who are All-Americans who I didn't know we're coming to our school who end up being, you know, being there. So I give the credit to Baltimore, and particularly the youth leagues, which is a heavy emphasis in this area. I mean, summer leagues in Baltimore from 8 years on up is really sophisticated. There's some great people who work with the kids, and they really provide a great program. So I get a lot of kids who know how to play the game, and I like to think I take them a step further. But some of the highlights have been of course, the first 2 years going to the NCAA tournament, and then our last year in Division II was 1986, and we went to the Division II tournament again. We led the nation in hitting. I think we hit .379 as a team and averaged over 10 runs a game, and then we made that jump to Division I, and we weren't sure how we were going to do. At least I wasn't sure, because we could we would pick and choose in Division II the Division I teams we would play locally, and we'd save our pitching and that type of thing, and we'd have success. So we'd play like 10 games against Division I competition when we were at the Division II level. And we got some recognition because we would beat some of the local Division I teams. But now we go to Division I, and we have to schedule all Division I teams. And wasn't so sure how we'd do, but from day one, we, you know, first year we were 29-13 in Division I, and I said, hey, guess what, we can still do it. And of course, we got support from our athletic program, our administration, so they started, you know, give me some resources in terms of recruiting some kids that was going to take some finances, some athletic grant money, and so I was able to recruit some so-called blue-chip kids, particularly pitchers, that type of thing. And the highlight, we've had a lot of success, you know, in Division I. And of course, the big highlight was last year when we went to the NCAA, you know, Division I, you know, regionals. And they had us play Miami in the first game. And so that was a big highlight for us.
Tell me how you felt going in against Miami. Did you, you know, that must have been like a pinnacle for you. Did you think you had a shot at all? Or?
Well, if I had, see, our goal, Mike, was to, we were in the East Coast Conference, which an automatic bid went along to the NCAA tournament, went to the winner of the the conference championships at the end of the season. So up here in this area in the Northeast, it never happens where a team gets an at-large bid, meaning the powers to be in the baseball world don't pick. It's almost like a token bid to the automatic bid for the conferences up in this area. And so we knew we had to win. Our goal was to go to the NCAA tournament, and our goal was to win that championship and at the end of the season. So what we did, I went ahead and scheduled everybody I could in terms of the best teams from, Virginia, everywhere, the Old Dominions, the VCUs, the Richmonds, the so-called programs that year in and year out have, they're there. They're nationally known. And first week out, we went down and played Old Dominion, a three-game set. We've been outside 3 days, and we beat them 2 out of 3. And then we started to understand a little bit that maybe we're really that good. So we start playing every game just as if we couldn't afford to lose it, because maybe we don't win the championship. But with this one-loss record, winning against teams that are nationally known, then we had to get consideration as an at-large bid.
Strength of schedule.
Right.
Yeah.
So the whole season, we were beating everybody. And we were 37 and I guess 9 going into the tournament, having beaten we had a great one-loss record. And then we went ahead and start rolling through our tournament, won the first 3 games, and all we had to do was beat Ryder College 1 game out of 2 to get the automatic bid, and they beat us 2 games. So at that point, it was kind of devastating for our kids. But looking back now, it's kind of a blessing in terms of a credibility put on our program, because now the NCAA, Tournament Selection Committee, has to look at the entire country to pick at large teams. They picked UMBC. So that said, to the national people that we are recognized as one of the best teams in the country. And, of course, they tested us by, putting us against Miami. But, I didn't know what to expect. Of course, they get all kinds of hype about how great these teams are. But having playing some of the better teams up in our region and handling them, I wasn't too concerned. And the way it turned out, losing 3-1 and, putting a pretty big scare into them, I just know our kids are looking forward to, there's no guarantees, but they know that they're capable of doing it again.
And how are you looking for this year? Do you have a lot of returning starters?
Yeah, we only lost one pitcher, and he's the young man who beat, pitched against Miami, struck out 10, and we lose 3-1. We lost him. St. Louis Cardinals signed him. We had a catcher, Bobby Mumma, sign early after his junior year. That's a big void to fill. A second baseman, our captain, who was more of a glue that held the team together. He was a very good performer. But we're going to bring in another one of our returning players to play that position. So we only lost really 3 key players, but the nucleus of that team is all back, and we had a pretty good recruiting year. So we think we're a little bit stronger this year. So the challenge is there for us.
You've been doing this for a while now, and you're still a young man. You still get a lot out of it. It's a big thrill for you to work with the kids?
Well, it's a big thrill. What I try to do is, and I tell the kids this, I could leave it. I could leave the game. What I get out of it now is it's just a great opportunity for these kids. And sometimes they don't totally appreciate that. They're 18, 19 years old. But, they're playing at a level right now that most kids who ever, played baseball would just love to have the opportunity to play. We travel and have an opportunity to go to the NCAA tournaments, those types of things. It's a great opportunity. So the biggest thrill I get out of coaching now is when a young man decides to have faith in me and what I'm teaching them, because, I can evaluate them as they come in the program. And based on their attitude and based on their athletic ability and present skill level, some of them have an opportunity just to become absolutely phenomenal college players. And if I really feel that way about a young man, then I'm just hoping he puts that faith in me to let me mold him and, adjust him, have him make some adjustments in his skill and mechanics, that type of thing. And when they do that and then they absolutely perform at a level they never thought, then that's the thrill for me. I tell the kids, the kids I get now, I could just put them on the field and never coach them, and we'll win half our games. That's not why I'm coaching. You know, if a kid can hit 500, potential hit 500, I want to work with them to reach that goal, that type of thing. So what I get out of coaching now is looking for those kids who believe in me, and then we work together and have that, you know, look at the end of the season and say, wow, you know, look what we did.
You have any interaction with the Orioles? They've got so many of their scouting people in their farm teams, Frederick Keys, now the Bay Sox and stuff.
Right.
You deal with them at all?
No, none of those folks. You know, of course, you know, Jim Gilbert's a local scouting director, and of course, known Jim for years. And so the only really contact I have with those folks is through, you know, the scouts and, of course, all the teams, because they – every year we've got players who are draftable in terms of have the ability to, you know, where they would, you know, possibly want to draft these kids. So we see them out the games all the time, and so we're in contact with them, and they want to know when so-and-so is pitching and that kind of stuff.
What about other aspects of your job? I assume you do more than just walk
right
around with a chart under your arm
right
on the field. I mean, do you get into all of do you enjoy the office, the administrative parts of your job?
I enjoy the recruiting part. And I say the recruiting part, particularly when someone comes on campus with their parents, because I think we have something to offer, and I think I have something to offer to them besides baseball in terms of my approach to, you know, what I'm going to offer their son in terms of those next 4 years being around me. And so I enjoy that part. Be honest with you, the all the regulations the NCAA puts on us now, because I've never been one, you know, because I'm the only head coach in terms of, full-time coaches. I have assistants who help out, but they're just on the field. So in terms of having a full-time recruiter on the road and those types of things and making phone calls for me, I don't have that. And so in the NCAA, which is, hey, I'm behind it and all that, but what we have to do is, you know, some of the paperwork and the documentation, that gets a little bit that's not fun. Let's just put it that way.
Now, I have personal experience, as we talked before, of you know, the summer programs that you run for the young kids.
Right.
And how did you are you doing that? Is that mostly a revenue generator and stuff like that?
Sure, that is. And for years, what I would do is, you know, people would hire me to work some of their camps, and then I woke up a little bit and say, wait a minute, you know, that's what I have to offer. And I had an opportunity to watch how other people do. There's a lot of good camps out there. But for a lot of them, they are, you know, just entertainment for the kids. And my biggest frustration has always been I'm getting, at our level, I get very good athletes, but, you know, only if they had learned proper, you know, refined skills years ago. So my focus on running my own camps were as I tell the parents, I say, what we're going to teach is exactly everything we teach the college players. So in hopes that this 8 or 9 year old can learn some just basic things, now he can apply those over the next 10 years. So the time we get him, he is going to have a chance to be awesome. So, you know, our kids enjoy our camps, but there's a lot of repetition, a lot of drills, you know, doing things properly.
Is baseball as popular today among the local youth as it was when you were growing up?
The only thing I don't see, Mike, and parents always ask me, because I'll see some kids who are so-called all-stars in the, you know, the 10 and under or 12 and under leagues, and I always ask the kids or ask the parents, they'll say, well, how good is little Johnny? And I'll, you know, and I have an idea that he needs to work a little bit more, and maybe his throwing mechanics aren't real good. And I tell them, I said, the game is a game of repetition. And I'll ask the kids how many own a Nintendo or how many kids watch TV. And during the summers, I think, the best way for kids to learn how to play the game is just to go out and play in the backyard, play wiffle ball, play wall ball, play. Just go play. You're not going to get any better in baseball by your two nights a week in the T League, and that's it. So And I think that's the difference. I think years ago, you know, when mom and dad would yell at you because you sit down and when they want you to eat dinner, you say, no, I got to go play. You know, it was across the lot with your buddy and you were just playing the game and you were just playing day and, I mean, just hour upon hour. And that's where the development really comes from, you know, just out there playing.
Well, yeah, I hope that I see that too. They're so distracted. There's so many
right.
other things to do. But, you know, but I was, you know, I grew up in the same area you did, and you played every day,
right.
all day, every day of the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the way it was.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. Well, let me think. What else do we need to talk about here? What's your record? 16 years. What's your record?
Wow. I won my 300th game last year, so I don't know. I guess like 335. I don't know. It's something like I've won 65% of our games, so whatever that comes out to. So
you're good. Congratulations.
Well, appreciate that.
Thanks for coming down and doing this.
Yeah.
Add on All-Star memory.
Right.
What's your favorite All-Star memory?
My favorite All-Star memory was when. Of course, growing up outside of Philadelphia, I was a Philadelphia fan, a Philadelphia Phillies fan, and my favorite player was Johnny Callison. And I can't give you the year that it was, but Johnny was in the All-Star game, and I guess it was a dramatic moment towards the end of the ball game, hitting a home run to win the ball game, and I just remember that because as a kid, that was whoever your favorite player was, and you wore his number and that type of thing, and for him to come into an All-Star game and be the hero was that time just a special time.
All right, talk.
Okay, I'm talking and
okay.
Can you pick it up? Is that fine?
Yep, I've got it. Now, we're here today with Julie Wagner, who works with the Baltimore Orioles, and Julie is working on the All-Star game in Baltimore this year. And you've got a pretty big role in coordinating the All-Star game. Can you tell us what your role is and how is it going?
Well, my role is as the All-Star coordinator is to interface between Major League Baseball and Major League Baseball properties and the local community. And really my job is to coordinate all the wonderful people that are working on our host committee to make all the exciting events that we have planned be successful that week.
You mentioned events. It's a full week's worth of activity. Can you tell us about some of the events that will be going on?
Sure. We have historically, the game was just a game. About 1978, they added the workout day, which is the day before the game, Monday, here in Baltimore. And that's about a four-hour event that has the Heroes of Baseball Legends game. It has a home run hitting contest and then workouts by the American League and National League. Well, then about 2 years ago, they added the All-Star Fan Fest, which is a theme park of baseball that'll be at the Convention Center and Festival Hall. Well, you know how we do everything better in Maryland and Baltimore. We're expanding that, and on Saturday night, there'll be a free symphony concert on Rash Field for families to, you know, kind of bring a blanket and have a wonderful event down there, a Pops concert with cartoon characters and hopefully some All-Stars type baseball players in attendance. And we are also planning street activities on Camden Street between Howard and Sharp Street, just kind of a free and open place people can walk through. And then a lot of the downtown attractions are also getting involved by having sports-themed attractions such as the Babe Ruth Museum and others during that period.
You went to the All-Star Game last year. And was that the first time you'd ever been to an All-Star game?
We actually sent a reconnaissance group to Toronto and then also to San Diego. Everyone from our stadium operations, ticketing, we all went out to see how they handled the games.
Did you like the game itself? Or was it a special game? You've been to a lot of baseball games. Was that a very special occasion for you?
It was a lot of fun, and I enjoyed seeing all those players that you don't usually get to see, and that's what makes the All-Star game so unique. It is the best in baseball, all in the same field.
You have been working in working with the Orioles for about
eight years. Well, okay. 10. I was part-time for 2 years as I started.
And right now you are the Director of Community Relations?
Actually, Community Services.
Community Services. Tell us about, you know, your time with the Orioles. How did you get involved with the ball club? Did you come to the team because you were a fan, or what's going on there?
I was in school, and I was looking for good experience in PR, and I was an Oriole fan, and was able to come on a part-time basis working games. And from there, my first year was a very exciting year, 1982, as everyone remembers. And then the second year I was part-time was 1983, so I really saw the heights of everything. And then I came on full-time, and since that time I've seen the lows, 1988, and also the resurgence of the Orioles as we go into this season. So,
a lot of hours. What would you say if someone wanted to get into to work for a Major League Baseball club? Tell about your typical day.
Well, if you want to work for a Major League Baseball club, know that you're giving up at least 13 of your weekends, and a lot of your days are your average days are 10-hour days, and your game days are 12 to 14-hour days. So,
but is it worth it?
Oh, it's a lot of fun, and it's unlike anything. You actually. It's kind of like having a second job in the evening as the game starts. If you have game duties, which we do, you're kind of going to your second job because it's different than your daily on the phone type of job. So,
you as close to the game as you are, have you been able to remain a fan as you were 8-10 years ago?
Surely, and I try to take a few games as we all do in the front office to sit out and be a fan to make sure we know what everyone is experiencing.
Very good. Thank you, ma'am.
All right.
Okay, we're here with Virginia Faubel, and we're going to do an interview for the WBAL Baltimore Baseball Minutes. And can you talk? Let me make sure I've got you. Just talk to me.
Oh, I can talk okay. I'm fine.
There you are. Okay, I think we're recording. Well, Virginia, you and your husband have had quite a role in the development of a lot of children regarding Baltimore baseball. And I was wondering if maybe we could start the interview by you just giving a recanting of how the two of you got involved in coaching amateur baseball, and maybe take us on up through the years.
All right. Well, back in 1946, some neighborhood boys came and stopped at the house and said, Mrs. Faubel, where's Mr. Sheriff? We want him to coach our baseball team. So I said, I think it's a great idea. He's over the bar playing cards. Why don't you go over and talk to him? And so Sheriff was ready for it because he had just finished playing ball himself and was sort of at odds and ends about what to do. And so that first year he talked to a friend at High's Ice Cream, Leon King, and Leon said yes, he would sponsor the team. So the team's uniforms were white with green on, and we played a short season for now because we only played like weekends. But the kids all said they could hit 500, and every pitcher said he could strike everybody out. But it wasn't quite like that. So Sheriff had to work, and he really got a team together. And although they started out not with a very good record at the beginning, they ended up the season as a winning season. So I think that was important. And as I said in the in our little book, I said that he learned more about coaching, and I had been drafted as a scorekeeper, and I demanded a book with bigger spaces in, a scorebook. Well, then on 47, he was able to get different players, and we had a very good team in 47, and we were playing in the Cardinal Gibbons, which was very prestigious, and we came out second in that tournament. But that was the beginning of a great 46 years, really.
What was the name of the team at the beginning?
High's Ice Cream.
High's Ice Cream team.
And then
who was the team captain of that first team, or do you remember?
The team captain was Bill Pfeiffer, who is he's now retired, but he was principal of Parkville High School when he retired, Overly High School when he retired, and he was the team captain at that year.
Was you know, as the years have gone on, and certainly you've had tremendous success through the years, have the boys that you influenced and coached and touched, have they stayed in touch with you?
Yes, and it's just great. It really is, because through the years we've gone to weddings and we've gone to baptisms, we've gone to bar mitzvahs, and then two boys that played ball for us, their sons, they had their sons come back and play ball for us, which was really interesting and great. And so that has kept us in touch with families throughout the years, and we are very fortunate. For instance, I'm not name dropping, but Ron Svoboda calls about once a month, and he lives in New Orleans, you know, and he just calls to chat, and we were always good friends with his mother and father. And then I visit Phil Lenz up in Stamford, Connecticut, and he has a son who is in the same age bracket as our boys, 14, 16. So Phil coaches a team up there. So that kind of brings us together, you know. Plus the other boys around town and the boys who have been in professional ball kept in touch. Tim Nordbrook, for instance, with the Orioles, has been very active with talking to me about things that perhaps can be done. And George Holland, who is another young man who lives in the neighborhood. And then when Sheriff was 50 years old, they celebrated, and he said he could never be 50 again because he had a celebration every night in the week, and he couldn't handle that. See, so one group were boys that played for him back in 49 and 50, and we had gone to their weddings, and so they had a surprise dinner for him. Well, from then on, because we were celebrating birthdays and anniversaries at the same time, we have been keeping that up and have done it for the past 27 years. And now we get together at the Hopkins Club, and there are 20 of us, and we're all in the Herman Room, and we have brunch, and it's once a year. So we think that's great, you know. Really.
It's quite an extended family.
It is. No children, but we've had a wonderful, wonderful group of children, really, boys.
Well, tell me about some of the teams. You've had great teams throughout, but you've had a couple of championship teams. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, I guess the most exciting era was the 49-50 and 51 group, because that's when Sheriff won the Cardinal Gibbons, which was very prestigious at that time. That was a prestigious tournament, and they used to have bands and color guards for the final games and all. So those 3 years are very important. And then 57 was an undefeated year, and that's very difficult to do because for a team to go through not losing a game. And that was an important, that was a very, very, very good ball, very good baseball team. And from 56 to 58, Sheriff's team won 82 straight games. So that was an exciting time, too. And then in 61, Al Kaline played for us in 1950. And then in 60, Dave Boswell. And Dave Boswell was another one that went into professional ranks, went into big leagues. And then Jim Spencer played for us in 62. Ron Svoboda played for us in 60 and 61. And Jim Spencer in 61 and 62. And a young man named Jerry Bark, who had great potential, he played for us in 62. So that era was an exciting era. Then in 65, we had another undefeated season. And that was a very good ball club. We had Bill Kelly played for us that year. He pitched, but that was an exciting year because the last game we won, the right fielder name was Stack, threw the kid out of home plate that would have put them ahead, for you know, the other team ahead. So that was an exciting time. Then of course we went through the 70s, but the 80s, Ron Bradley came and helped Sheriff, began working with Sheriff in 1980. And when we were up to the Hall of Fame, Sports Hall of Fame to see Al Kaline inducted. He took the team, and they went on and won the national championship for the National Amateur Baseball Federation. And then in 1981, again, we won that national championship. And then in 1984, we went into the national. And that was the first year that Sheriff ever went away with the team. He always let Ron take the team away if they were to go away. But he went away that year, and they rented a van, and he drove up with Ron Bradley, and they had six of the kids in the team, and they had their music on the radio. Well, he almost died, you know, going. But then they won the championship, and coming back, he said the best time he'd ever had, they slept all the way home, so then he could have his music on and have quiet, you know. But that was, they were exciting years. Those 1980s were exciting. Then we kind of, you can't stay on the pinnacle all the time, you know. And so then we went, in 1989, we went to Ohio for the regionals of the NABF, and we won those. But coming home, Sheriff had developed phlebitis, and so he couldn't go with them to Detroit into the finals, and they lost in the finals. So in 1990, he had the greenest team he had ever had. I mean, all the kids were real young, really young. And one boy played in this one game. He struck out three times, and he came back from the third time and sat down and took his shoes off. And one of the kids on the team said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I never struck out three times in all my life playing baseball. I'm no good for this team. I'm leaving." And everybody said, "Oh, no, don't go." No. And so Sheriff had to get put his shoes back on again. And all. They were a really young team. And then, of course, 91 was we had a nice team. And the big thing was we went to the Naval Academy. We would go to the Naval Academy to play that year, and it poured down rain. We didn't get there, but that was an exciting year. And of course, that was a 90 was Sheriff's 45th year, and so we had a big celebration set up for the awards night. And the awards night was always held in December. We've had an awards night ever since we ever had a team, and we always had it in December because if kids would graduate and go away to college, at least it was the time when they could come back. And Walter Yauss used to have his awards night, and during that same week, once in a while we'd hit the same night, but we tried not to. And so this is 1990, we had it set up. We had boys coming back from every team, and Denny Cox was the master of ceremonies. And it was absolutely the worst night we had had in 2 years. It snowed. It started snowing at 4 o'clock. People couldn't get there. And Vince Bagley came in at the beginning of dinner. And he came and he said to Bill Becker, "You don't have anybody in there." And Bill said, "You're the 81st. We had expected about 125, and we had 81. But anyway, we had a very, very fine awards night was what we had. And going home, it was all right. And we didn't have a bad night the rest of the year. That was the worst night. But and then, of course, 91, Sheriff died. But we still had the awards night. And we still keep going with the most valuable player, the most improved player, the Al Kaline Sportsmanship Award. We now have a Sheriff Fallible Unsung Hero Award that goes in there, too. The most valuable player is chosen by the teammates. And then the improved, most improved player and the Al Kaline Sportsmanship is chosen by the coaches on the team. And the Unsung Hero Award is chosen at this point by me. interestingly enough, in 1953, the Most Valuable Player Award was shared. Most Valuable Player Award was shared by two boys. Barry Burns was one. Jerry McCarron was the other. I'm not sure. So Sheriff said, "Well, we won't have that happen again. We'll have a system whereby the boys vote for three votes. The first one is the first boy they vote for gets 5 points, the second one 3 points, and the third one 1 point." He said, "So we'll never have to worry about a tie." Well, interesting enough, in 1974, we had a tie. And it was Dave Hollifield and Moose Hawes, both pitchers, and they both came out with exactly the same number of points. And interestingly enough, this year's team, we had a tie on the 1992 team between Eric Tuppett and Mark Tuschkowski. And so we had another tie, which was unusual. Yeah,
all these years, how many children have gone on to play in the majors?
Well, we have 13 now. Brian Bark just came up. The Atlanta Braves brought him up in September. So I'm sure that this year he's gone to spring training with the Major League Club. So that's the 13th, yes. So.
Who's the best player, you would think, that has come through all these years? Is it easy to pick one? Or
no, it's very difficult. But as Sheriff said, that you have to look at Al Kaline because he has made the Hall of Fame. But then, you know, there was Ron Svoboda who beat the Orioles in the 1969 World Series. And there's Dave Boswell, who had a very good record. There's Jim Spencer, who went to major league career very well. And I was thinking, we have had about five that have been on teams that have won World Series. So that's interesting, too.
That's a thrill. Yeah, right. Obviously, the two of you have performed lots of magic over the years with all the children. What special quality did your husband have that made it work, that made him work so well with the boys?
Understanding. He was, I think he understood boys. I really do. And he was they don't believe this kid then, but he was really a calm person. He was a sensitive person. He wasn't an up and down. I'm an up and downer. I get run hot and cold, and he kind of kept me on an even keel. But I think, and he was an excellent judge of baseball players. He was of talent. And as you know, well, I don't know whether you know or not, but in 1951, when Al Kaline came to try out for the team, Sheriff had an excellent second baseman, and Al Kaline was a second baseman. So Sheriff made him an outfielder, and that's how he became an outfielder. But he had a very good judge. He was a good baseball man. I don't think there are too many in the country that were any better than Sheriff in baseball. He knew baseball, and he knew baseball talent, and he was good at coaching. He could help a boy. If he had a problem, he could help him to work out of that problem. And so I think that was his understanding of kids, and his baseball knowledge was great. And he had no peer in baseball knowledge. And I don't care who he was. I'll say that he had no peer, really, in baseball knowledge.
Casey Stengel visited your house at one time. What is that? Can you tell us about that time?
Well, it was the 1970 when the Mets came down for the World Series. The Orioles were in the World Series. And the Mets came down, and Sheriff arranged for them not the Mets team, but the manager in the office, and Casey was part of that, you know, and I at this point I can't remember, but they came, so they went to Hausner's. They loved going to Hausner's. So Sheriff arranged for them all to go to Hausner's, and then they came down our house afterwards, and Casey came in and looked at the paneled room, which you've seen, and he said, "Little Hall of Fame." And Sheriff was, Sheriff, we have some pictures of the boys who have made the big leagues on the one wall. And he went over and he said, "I know that one, and I know that one, I know that one, but I don't know this one." And it was Sheriff. Sheriff had a baseball uniform on. I had his picture there, you know. I don't know this one. And our favorite story on Casey is he said to Pete Gebrin, he said, "I want a scotch and soda." And so Pete got him a scotch and soda, and he up one drink. He said, no, I want that stuff you don't smell. He wanted vodka. I said, I want that stuff you don't smell, he said. But a very interesting person. He really was. And we enjoyed that whole evening. It was great.
Well, you had a life full of interesting baseball minutes. And would you trade it in for anything? Would you do it over in any different way? Or?
Oh, no. I think the way it was done was the right way. We stayed with the same level. That's another thing. Sheriff always kept the same level of age group. He said it was the most coachable. And also, they hadn't gotten into girls yet. Not too many, and some of them did, but not, and they couldn't drive, usually they were at 16 just driving a car, you know, and so that's the level he took, and that was great, you know, and it was great getting to know the parents and being with the parents, I don't think I changed anything, no, mm-mm, it was great, everything was just great, really. Like the Sandlots. It's the Sandlots are good area to be in, you know. Really it is.
I concur. Yeah. You did a great interview. I think we'll
thank you.
Okay. This is a pickup with Virginia Falbel, talking about her husband's career. And maybe we can start off, I'll hold it this time, with the fact that in addition to his role with amateur baseball, he also had quite a role in scouting for the professional ranks.
Yes.
He
was 15 years with Cincinnati Reds, and Johnny Noon, who was a manager for the Cincinnati Reds at that time, was the one that got Sheriff into scouting for them. And then he decided he wouldn't scout anymore because he didn't have the time to do the territory because of having his own team. And so Pete Gebrin wrote him when the Mets were forming and said they wanted to scout for this area, and did he know of anybody? And so at that time, Sheriff thing. I said, well, why don't you apply? Why don't you go? Well, they wanted Sheriff, but they didn't want to say that in the beginning. So then he had 22 years with them. It was a great relationship. It really was. He enjoyed the Mets very much, and we did a lot of things with them. And of course, signing Ron Swoboda was a big thing because Ron went on to play, and that was a big thing. And then this Jerry Bark I told you about, he signed him, but Jerry he was in the Triple A, and he thought he'd go up to major leagues, but he didn't. And then he decided that he was going to another career. But
so how did that? You know, with all the scouting and being the manager of the amateur teams, what did he do for a living, and where did he get time to do it?
Well, he worked for Bethlehem Sparrows Point Shipyard, and his hours. He not only got a vacation, but he could accumulate days and everything. So much of his scouting was done that way. And then, too, he only scouted within the metropolitan area. He did not go into the other states for the Mets. And that was understandable with them. They understood that. And so that's the way he did it. But he was supervisor of counters. Now, his men counted the work the welders did on the ships. And that was a group of men that he had. Now, he started at Bethlehem in 1936, and the way he got his job was he was a star athlete at Western Maryland College and a very good basketball player. And they had basketball teams down at Bethlehem, and so they recruited Sheriff. And that's what. And of course, he was glad to get the job because 36 was Depression time and all. And so that's how he got the job as working with Bethlehem. He worked in the accounting department. And then he played on weekends for baseball in Carroll County, and he also got paid $5 a game, which was extra money, so he looked forward to that. Well, his team happened to play a Bethlehem team. And his boss saw Sheriff play and wanted to know why he wasn't playing for the Bethlehem team. And Sheriff said, well, he played for the Carroll County team. And he said, I think you should play for Bethlehem teams. So Sheriff had to play. Even then he didn't get his money, you know, again. But that's how he began with Bethlehem. And so he worked for Bethlehem for 42 years. He retired in 77 from Bethlehem. And he had, his boss was Roy Statton, who was a senator for Maryland, a Maryland senator in legislature. And so he would often fill in for Roy, take care of Roy's job when Roy was in legislature. So then Roy kind of helped Sheriff when he had to be someplace, and so he would let him maybe leave at exactly 4 o'clock so he could go, and that's how they worked things out.
That's pretty smart.
Yeah, right.
Okay.